Okay, so the original idea for the quarter was a whole series of lectures about this stuff and other people, and that never happened. One of those quarters. Right, so I did a little introduction to supersymmetry and geometry before, and today I want to mention what I'm taking as my main source. So it's this Quantum Fields and Strings, A Guide for Mathematicians book.
Did you write any of the sections that you're using today?
It's hard to remember, but I think not. I guess it does have a footnote. Chapter it says who wrote it? Maybe it does. Okay, let's find out. I don't think I wrote these. No, I think John Morgan wrote these. And so I'm looking at Volume 2, Witten's lectures that are in Volume 2. And 16, 17, 18. So in my broader introduction, which was at the beginning of the quarter, I talked about various supersymmetry algebras, which are Z2 graded Lie algebras that are extensions of the Poincaré algebra. And the one that I'm going to be most focused on today is going to be the algebra in four dimensions with eight supercharges. And the other notation for that algebra is n equal 2, script n equal 2 in four dimensions. So The spinner representation of the little group in four dimensions is dimension 4, which is why you could the minimal amount of supersymmetry you could have in four dimensions is 4 supercharges, and we're doing twice that minimal amount, which is what the script n equal 2 notation refers to. So if you're writing down theories with 8 supercharges, The usual way it's done, and I'll explain why in just a minute, is to write them, so written in terms of n equal 1 superfields. So one thing I mentioned in the earlier introduction was this strategy that one can have of classifying representations of the supersymmetry algebra. And typically, a given irreducible representation, which is called a multiplet in these theories, decomposes into various kinds of Poincaré representations, which are the particle types. And they're described by a spin or helicity, generally speaking. That's one of the kind of key features for describing them. There's an extension of this idea, which is to try to write a space. So the idea of superspace is to find a supermanifold which extends Minkowski space. Okay, I'm going to say it extends Minkowski space, but in practice, we're actually going to be writing Euclidean signature versions of physical theories, so it could extend Euclidean space instead, if you're doing that case, which extends those and gives meaning to the odd variables. So the extends this to a space with both even and odd coordinates. And if you're able to do this, then you can use you can sort of write the whole multiplet as one variable, and that variable can be manipulated. They can be multiplied together. They might be group valued, in which case if you take a product of two, you could have a trace. There are various things that that you could do with these things. And in particular, if you've got a superspace formalism to describe the theory that you're looking at, you can write relatively compact equations which describe, say, a Lagrangian of a physical theory with supersymmetry, in which all of the supersymmetry properties, or many of the supersymmetry properties, have been packaged into the superspace notation. So there's always this exercise that one could do to take the superspace formulated Lagrangian and write out the full component Lagrangian, actually usually after integrating over the fermionic fields. And when you do that, you turn a nice compact formula into a huge messy formula. And so for lots of manipulations, it's nice to have the compact formula. So there are, I should mention, that there are good superspace formulations I hardly want to mention one supercharge, so let me just say for two supercharges, or four supercharges, so I'll mention the kind of multiplets, that supermultiplets that we'll be looking at for four supercharges, and there's kind of a good one. There is something called harmonic superspace. For eight supercharges, and it has its fans, but it also has its detractors. So there's not a universal agreement that it's a good thing to use harmonic superspace. In particular, you end up with an infinite number of components in a superfield, and okay, I guess one of the reasons that I'm less of a fan is that somebody trained in mathematics, I'm a little more worried about what to do with my infinite components and convergence questions and so on. So I'm working with an A-supercharge theory, but I don't want to try to give a harmonic superspace formulation. I'll try to write the theory in terms of N equal 1 superfields.
So Dave?
Yeah.
Are you going to explain more about good or bad? So it seems like at the moment, good or bad is people like it or not. It has like a mathematical meaning besides, you know.
Okay, and maybe I'll say there are no known ones. There is no known one for greater than eight supercharges.
Okay.
So what happens when you have greater than eight supercharges, in fact, it's even worse than not being able to write down superspace. There is no known off-shell formulation of supersymmetry. So typically in physical theory, you're writing down a configuration space of fields, and then you have something like a Lagrangian in my formulation. There are also Hamiltonian ways of looking at these things, sort of describing the physics. And there's a weak form of symmetry that you can have, which is to say that if you apply the symmetry to the Lagrangian, say, that what you get is the same up to something that's exact, which will integrate to zero. So up to the equations of motion. Or you could be really lucky and have the symmetry actually preserve the Lagrangian. So the first one is called off-shell because it works even if you haven't satisfied the equation of motion. The second one is not. It's only a symmetry of the solutions of the theory. It's not a symmetry of the full theory. And although the 16 and 32 supercharge theories are really beautiful and people want to study them for lots of reasons, they don't have these off-shell formulations. And so that introduces another complication. And A supercharges is kind of in the middle. The fact that you're having trouble closing it is what makes you introduce more and more fields into this harmonic superspace formalism. And having introduced a countable number of fields, the question is, what did you gain, right? Was it really necessary to do that or not? So the much more common approach to eight supercharge theories is to write them in terms of the four supercharge Lagrangians and then impose extra conditions which would guarantee the extra symmetry. So what I'm going to do is describe gauge theories in this context. I'm going to describe them a little bit crudely to sort of to highlight the properties that the Lagrangians would have. And I'm actually going to describe them first n equals 0, so no supersymmetry, then n equal 1, minimal supersymmetry, then n equal 2, the symmetry that's interesting for the Zeigarnik-Witten theory and also for gravity theories in which you've compactified the type 2 string on Calabi-Yau manifolds, and I'll indicate some of the interesting features of that and probably also tell you how you turn a Calabi-Yau manifold into one of these n equal 2 theories. Now, one of the key features that make these interesting in physics is the question, how do these theories behave at different energy scales? So this is the question of renormalization of the theories, how the theories change with the energy scale. And I'm not going to touch on that at all, but that was sort of Witten's point in these lectures. So I won't get to it, but it's good to keep in mind. I'm happy to say that these notes were written prior to the introduction of one of the most abominable notations that I've ever seen, which has become commonplace in recent, at least high-energy papers. Okay, so a Lagrangian has a bunch of terms, and I've just written one with one term, and if I were contemplating putting in other terms, I might put plus dot, 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 but you would understand that it was one term. The notation, which I just hate, is this one. Have people seen this?
No.
It's just awful. A Lagrangian is not a set of which this is a subset, right? It's just horrible. But and so the paper that one of the two papers I put out recently had to force my co-authors to not use that.
Are they using this notation now?
A lot of people are using it. It's just horrible. Okay, so here is my basic 4D gauge theory Lagrangian. So what do I have in mind? I start with A, which is a Lie algebra value gauge field. So it transforms sort of like a one-form, but not quite like a one-form. If you have the difference of two, they transform like a one-form, valued in G. And then there's a curvature, dA plus a wedge A is what the sort of standard way of describing the curvature. And again, it's an algebra value curvature, which is a two-form. Now, I'm in four dimensions, so there's a Hodge-Star operator. That's what this is. And that Hodge-Star operator takes two forms to two forms. Another way of writing f wedge f star is to simply write norm f squared. So I'm using the metric on the four-manifold. The four-manifold is really just Minkowski or Euclidean space, but this formalism is adapted to more general four-manifolds. The metric on the four-manifold induces norms on the various p-form bundles. You might have to, if you're trying to do a norm of a one-form, you might have to have another term in there. But for the middle cohomology, it's nice. It's just f wedge star f. And then the trace here is a trace in the algebra G. So I had two algebra indices in here, and I'm thinking of taking the product in the algebra to enable myself to write a trace. Okay, so that's the standard starting point for gauge theories in four dimensions. If the algebra is abelian, then you don't need the a wedge a term. It's just a theory of one forms and two forms. If the algebra is not abelian, then Yang and Mills in the 1950s figured out that that was the good thing to do if you wanted to study gauge fields. One important point about gauge theories is that these theories are invariant under an action of the group whose algebra is G. The group and algebra here are real groups and algebras. in a little bit, I hope to come to the complexification and the role that the complexification plays, but at the moment, they're real groups and algebras. The key thing about gauge theory is that all physical quantities, measurable quantities, are supposed to be gauge invariant. So when I write the gauge field, hopefully people know this from the study of electromagnetism, if you write the electromagnetic potential, that's not actually a physically measurable thing. It induces things that can be measured, but the physical quantities are the actual invariant quantities. So what do I need to do to make this supersymmetric? I was going to do one more thing, which was, the advantage of that notation is that you don't have to keep numbering your Lagrangians or whatever. So I'm going to decorate my Lagrangian, maybe with a tilde, so I'll have my original one, my 1 over 4g squared, trace f wedge star f. And this other term I'm going to introduce is really not visible if you're working over just Euclidean or Minkowski space, but it becomes important if you're working over arbitrary manifolds. This is a so-called topological term. Oh, I need a trace. It's a so-called topological term, where instead of taking the star, you just wedge F with itself. And putting that in is essentially measuring the topology of the bundle, the G bundle, in which you're taking values. So on a more complicated manifold, you would actually be required to specify a G bundle, then the gauge field would be a section of the G, one form of values in the G bundle, and this topological term would be measuring the topology of that G bundle. And there's the coefficient here, the gauge coupling, was an important part of the physical theory, and the topological term also gets a so-called theta angle. You can choose to add it with any theta angle that you like. And already, when I've written it in this form, it's apparent that I'm writing the Euclidean theory, not the Minkowski signature theory. In Minkowski signature theories, you're required to have real Lagrangians. In this Euclidean theory, certain terms naturally turn into complex or imaginary terms. And that's very convenient in this situation because we've got some sort of interesting pairing between a real and imaginary part of this Lagrangian, and we'll exploit that more when we get to supersymmetry.
Okay, Dave, okay, I'm really glad you mentioned this point. So does that mean when back to Minkowski, I need to change that I to -1 or something?
Yes, something.
Because we agree we need a real, you know, Lagrangian.
That's right. I think even in Minkowski's signature, there is a complex parameter, and it might be more accurate to say that you're going to get an I in front of the topological term. And
that's another way.
Yeah.
But we need to get real, right?
We need to get a real, okay. Yeah, real number, absolutely. Right, so we'll eventually have a combination tau equals 1 over 4g squared plus I theta over 16 pi squared. And really, it's, if you like, tau plus tau bar and tau minus tau bar, which you care about if you write things down. So for n equal 1, this curvature is part of a multiplet. In fact, the gauge field itself is part of a multiplet. So we maybe initially try to avoid writing things explicitly in terms of the gauge field, but it is convenient to have the gauge field around. And I didn't write a note in the notepad, but the multiplet here consists of the gauge field a fermion lambda, and a field that's traditionally called D, which is, this is a bosonic field. I think it's a scalar. But it's quadratic in the action. So the only way it appears is the square of D in the action. Actually, there's probably a linear term also, and then you complete the square and you have something squared. And because of that purely algebraic squared term, you can do what's called integrate that out of the Lagrangian in the theory. You don't really need a field that doesn't have a kinetic term and only is only entering in the interactions through a quadratic term. You can write an effective theory without that. And so this is called an auxiliary field. And it's there so that the supersymmetry transformation does a nice thing. So it's necessary to include it if you're going to write things using this superfield, but the more fundamental version of the theory wouldn't include the D at all. So this is another reason about, you know, why people argue about whether to use a superspace formalism. You almost always have to introduce these auxiliary fields, which aren't affecting the equation of motion, but they are affecting the configuration space. You can argue a little bit about whether they have a true impact on the physics or not.
So lambda, you said, is a fermion.
Lambda is a fermion.
It's
that's
a
Grassmannian
number valued, or it just...
Well, I should think of it as a spinner bundle on the space valued.
It's a spinner.
So that's spinner valued. So the way that you include now I'm going to label it n equal 1. The way that you include the fermion into the action, so I'm still writing my two gauge kinetic terms. I'm sorry. This is all true. But what I wanted to do first was write down a fermion, an action with fermions. So over here, I simply described the action with a gauge field, which is only appearing in the Lagrangian through its curvature. But I can imagine coupling that to fermionic fields, which had a G action. I've got to have everything be invariant under G action, so there should be some representation of G. And my my extended Lagrangian then will have some terms, and the terms look like, okay, so I have to add in chiral fermions, which are left-handed, and psi I star, which are right-handed, and to get a theory that's free of local anomalies, I want the number of left-handed and the number of right-handed guys to be the same. And then those are, and so we're exploiting the fact that the spinner bundle is actually a complex bundle. There are two spinner bundles. They're complex bundles. Okay, so I am in Euclidean signature right now. So it's SO4 I'm studying, but SO4 is SU2 cross SU2. And you see the left and right spinners as the complex two bundle from one of the SU2s, complex two bundle from the other SU2, but they're complex valued, so they also have complex conjugates. And the term that you put in the Lagrangian is a pairing between, okay, I'm sure I get my, this is right. So I want the complex conjugate of psi to be paired with, and now I have to operate by the Dirac operator on psi I star, and then I also take the other way, psi I star bar paired with, so there's a pairing on the spinner bundle, and I'm using it, Dirac times psi I. Okay, so that's the only way that you ever can put in fermion terms in Lagrangian is to use the Dirac operator, and that's the natural way to include them in this context, in four-dimensional gauge theory.
So this NF, that's a parameter. You can choose, or it has to be determined.
NF is the number of fermions.
Yeah, but I'm asking you, if that's determined, or you can wear that as a parameter.
So it better be a sum of representation numbers of G, because I want everything to be invariant under some action of G.
Okay.
You might take the trivial action, in which case there would be no constraint whatsoever, but there are actually different characteristics of the physical theory depending on what representation you choose. So I'm writing down a general form, but the behavior in the infrared, if you let renormalization run, will be quite different for different cases. Okay, so now I can say the n equal 1 case. So the n equal 1 Lagrangian is just supposed to look like my topological terms, excuse me, my kinetic term for the gauge field and my topological term, which aren't changing at all here, and then all I do is add in a single, so now I'm going to use lambda for the spinner, and there's an I in there. Can't really explain it. Seem to be there. But lambda is going to be adjoint value. Spinner. So I told you that the group had to act on the spinners, and now I want it to be an adjoint valued spinner. And as I say, this G value gauge field A goes with this adjoint valued spinner and this auxiliary field whose properties I've forgotten and didn't write down in my notes.
But it's also not in the action.
Right, so I've just suppressed it from the action.
Okay, so
I should say plus something quadratic in D.
Okay.
So there's another thing that you could do in n equal 1. N equal 1 has also chiral superfields in addition to vector superfields. And the chiral superfield is a triple consisting of a scalar. Okay. I'm going to write it with a capital letter. This is not good notation. A scalar, a fermion, and an auxiliary field, F. Okay, there are many, many problems with this notation. One of them is that this auxiliary field, F, is not to be confused with the curvature of the gauge field, but the same letter, F, is being used. So I'm going to call this one F hat or something, just so that we... but it's not going to do anything, so we don't care. And the, so this is a complex scalar. And this is another fermion. And this over here is auxiliary. I think it's a scalar.
Is it a drag fermion?
Well, that's a good question. Is that one supposed to be Majorana and that one supposed to be Dirac? Is that what's going on?
Maybe. Possible. I think this one, the psi is Dirac. I just always wondered why they call this a chiral superfield.
That probably means it's not Dirac.
Right. Yeah, it must be, right? It must just be from it must just be from one of the half spin bundles, right? Because there's also the anti-chiral superfield in which you just take the complex conjugate of this and maybe none of my formulas have this written out right now, so I don't know. So the term in the Lagrangian that's associated to this, which modern people would write with the set inclusion, but not me, looks like, so you could do, right, okay, so I hadn't really been specifying the measure in these terms, but now I want to say something about what I'm integrating over. Because the typical term You're integrating over all four space-time variables, and you're also integrating over all four Grossmann variables in this particular case. Those you might not have thought you had four Grossmann variables, but you have two n equal one supersymmetry. I wonder if it was a typo. No, it's fine. I'm integrating over all of the Grossmann variables, and I have trace of phi bar phi. But there's another term you can put in, which is an interaction term, which could have some coefficient epsilon. Not really meaning to imply epsilon is small. And that just looks like trace of phi squared, trace of phi phi. So just like I had the topological term, which I could use to modify the kinetic term for the gauge field, I have something that looks a little more as if it were going to be topological. It's not a topological term. It's an interaction term for the field. And more generally, a term like this, a polynomial in the chiral fields, this could be more generally something known as the superpotential, which specifies the interaction of the chiral fields. So it's a polynomial, the trace of a polynomial in phi.
So do you mean d squared theta or d fourth theta?
I mean d squared theta in this case.
So that only has two.
That's correct. So in
how do you choose them?
Right. So the point is that this is a holomorphic function, and so you only have to integrate over the holomorphic thetas that are involved. And you should also write, with this epsilon, you should write plus complex conjugate, because you should take the other two thetas and integrate the complex conjugate of your polynomial over the other two thetas. So these two types of terms, a kinetic term for the chiral superfield, and the so-called superpotential term, are very common types of things that you see in n equal 1 gauge theory. Let me remark.
But Dave, did you finish? Because I assume you don't need to write anything for F, which is quadratic, you can integrate on. But how about a fermion?
Yeah, I should write a fermion term, and I didn't write it down.
Okay, so there should be a fermion term.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. I should say plus fermion term. I wonder if I just forgot to copy this here.
It's since you're in superspace, one of those terms when you expand out becomes a.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I'm writing. So I this really should probably have been the notation should have been capital phi is this with the lowercase phi, and what this really means is that I'm writing something like phi plus a one of the thetas times a lambda, maybe another theta times the psi bar, and then something that involves a couple of thetas and the f. I'm not swearing that that's the right formula, but it has that general form. And so I'm plugging that into an expression like this. And so there's automatically fermions in it.
Okay,
thank you, Matt. So the remark is that in n equal 2, epsilon equals 0. So these superpotential terms, which are really important for the physics in n equal 1, are just completely absent in n equal 2. That's one of the features of having the n equal 2 the extra supersymmetry structure. So, okay. So I kind of wrote down the various things that you will encounter if you're doing gauge theory coupled to a fermion, gauge theory coupled to some scalar fields, which in the n equal 1 language are taking the role of chiral superfields. And now I want to mention what happens with n equal 2. So n equal 2 in four dimensions Again, there are two interesting kinds of multiplets. There's the n equal 2 vector multiplet. Because the n equal 2 algebra contains the n equal 1 algebra as a subalgebra, of course I could decompose all the way down to Poincaré, but I could decompose to n equal 1 multiplets and ask what I get. And an n equal 2 multiplet is equal to an n equal 1 vector plus, or union, whatever you want to call it, an n equal 1 chiral. So I get one of each in my n equal 2 vector multiplet, and so I definitely have to have a kinetic term involving the n equal 1 chiral that's associated to the gauge field in n equal 2. And then there's a so-called n equal 2 hypermultiplet, and that equals an n equal, that can be thought of as two two separate or complex conjugates. I think that's n equal 1 chiral plus n equal 1 antichiral. Okay, I don't swear that it's... I seem to remember that it's two chirals, not a chiral and an antichiral. That, again, was not in the notes I was looking at today. So when we describe an n equal 2 theory, so what we want to do is write it in terms of the vector multiplet, and the vector multiplet is going to determine a curvature. So the curvature is in a spinner-valued multiplet. And the key component is something that we're going to call W, or W sub A. So this is G value. That's what the index is indicating. And it's a component of the curvature of this vector multiplet. So how do I define curvature? I have to do this similar sort of thing. I have to take a derivative, but I'm applying an appropriate covariant derivative in this context. That covariant derivative involves both even and odd derivatives, appropriately construed. And so I could write my components, the a and the lambda, and the phi and the psi of the n equal 2 vector, and then work out a component of the curvature. And the only one that really, you can write things as if there were just the one component you care about in the Lagrangian, if you write the Lagrangian in the following form. So this W is, when you write things out, the n equal 2 Lagrangian looks as follows. It's an I over 4 pi, d4x, d4 theta, a tau, which in principle depends on phi, and then you've got to take the trace of the W. So the W includes both the star part and the unstar part sort of coming all together. And it turns out that you can sort of summarize the entire Yang-Mills part of the Lagrangian that way. And then there's another term, which is a kinetic term for the... the kinetic term for the hypermultiplet, potentially. Right. So So here's my W. So this had curvature W in supermultiplet notation, and this had this was a hypermultiplet labeled by phi and phi bar. So I guess it was an antichiral. It was labeled by phi and phi bar, and k of phi phi bar is an appropriate function. So the k of phi phi bar is going to generalize the trace of phi bar phi, which I had over here. I'll explain how in 1 second. And the curvature terms are all sort of packaged into that. The tau has a real part and an imaginary part. And what we're actually doing with the tau is letting it depend on the chiral fields. So this tau varies holomorphically with phi. That's what it means to write that tau could be dependent on phi in this formulation. So let me write out what this is, if you do a little bit of component integration there.
So that's the whole Hamiltonian?
Lagrangian. I know you do Hamiltonians, but we do Lagrangian.
I was supposed to do the x at the turn into Hamiltonian, but I couldn't do it. But that's the whole thing. That's all.
You know, the supergravity people or supersymmetry people will tell you that Hamiltonian formulations are really awkward because they're trying to be relativistic from the outset, and so they don't want to separate time,
yeah.
And so they want a Lagrangian instead. That's, you know, that's the philosophy. I know that your friends all do Hamiltonian.
Yeah, yeah. They've never heard the word Lagrangian. Yeah,
right. So, oh, they've heard it, but not since they were undergrads or something.
After school.
Yeah, right. Okay, so I wanted to write this out in component form. So in component form, so this is L n equal 2 still. And what I'm doing is I'm doing the fermion integrals. So what does it mean to do the fermion integrals? Remember, we discussed last time that doing a fermion integral was more or less like differentiating with respect to fermions in the process. And so if you had some kind of chain rule differentiation you had to do, you would end up doing derivatives, for example, of K in the process of integrating out all of those fermions. So what you end up getting, in fact, is from the first term, you get a tau bar times the self-dual part of the curvature wedged with itself. Okay, so I'd have to write f plus or minus, star of f plus or minus is plus or minus f plus or minus, right? I have to split the curvature into the self-dual and anti-self-dual parts.
But Dave, can I ask a question before you continue? So I find this Lagrangian really strange in the following sense. The vector multiplet and the hypermultiplet basically completely decouple.
Not completely. This is the place.
Yeah, there's only one
right.
thing,
that's right.
which is
that's
the,
right.
only the coupling constant depends on.
That's right.
Okay, so that's what they really they want. It's a worm. Well, anyway, I just felt it's a couple so minimal.
The coupling is so minimal because this very stringent symmetry has to be respected, right? So you would get interesting couplings involving, even in n equal 1, there's not, there's still a dichotomy between the stuff belonging to a chiral multiplet and belonging to a vector multiplet. There, maybe it's less surprising because the only scalar in the picture belonged to chiral multiplet, the only vector in the picture belonged to vector multiplet, and writing down a direct coupling between a scalar and a vector is not something that you normally do, right? So, but here I agree, you've got superfields, you might think that these two different kinds would interact more, but they don't. So minus tau times F minus wedge F minus plus a 2 derivative, and now the lowercase indicates that I'm just using the initial scalar component in that multiple, which I should have been doing from the beginning, the lowercase. And then there's an m tau times fermion, and I'm writing the covariant Dirac operator with respect to the gauge field component of the vector multiple, right? And then I do have a term, which is the Kähler form applied to the psi component. So there were these two different gauge fields. And that one has to be weighted with the Kähler form. So that's the result of applying, of doing those integrals with all of the various pieces involved in the integral. And the K phi phi is called the Kähler potential. So K little phi, if I just evaluate it there, is a Kähler potential, which means that this expression, which I'll now write in differential terms, this expression d phi bar, okay, there should be indices because I can have more than one phi, right? I'm allowed to have multiple hypermultiplets, but this is a Kähler metric. So it got more complicated. I have suppressed all sorts of indices about who's valued in which. I mean, there is a trace here, an implicit trace here, because that guy was adjoint valued. These guys were not adjoint valued, but you needed they have an implicit phi that they belong to, and that's why there's the metric that's measuring which one you're looking at.
But Dave, I didn't see the Kähler potential in the Lagrangian
denominator.
Where the Kähler?
Yeah, it's right here, K phi phi bar.
But not in here.
What you're seeing is its derivatives, right?
Oh, only comes in derivatives.
Only comes in derivatives. Okay. No, that's the beauty. I mean, that's why. So, because you're doing these theta integrals, whatever appeared to be your Lagrangian is going to show up with its derivatives taken. And so, how are you going to get a metric? Well, you have to have a metric with the property that the ij component of the metric is actually a second derivative from some potential function. There are such things for real derivatives. The potential has a name. Anyway, there are some real metrics which have this property that the GIJ is actually two derivatives of some function, some potential function. It has a familiar name of a 19th century mathematician. I just can't think of what it is. But then the Kähler ones also have this property. So there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of complex structure in here, which is, again, a consequence of having this big supersymmetry. You can show that you had to have complex structure and that the only kind of metrics in my simplest example, this was just phi bar phi, right? There's just one of them, and then the derivative would have just been one. We would have just had flat metric on that space. But this allows for a more complicated story. In fact, more generally, there are interesting classes of models. So you can write down what's called a sigma model with target capital X, which is a Kähler manifold. And in that sigma model, you should have phi mapping from space-time to the target. So we can write local coordinates, and when we write local coordinates, there will be in those local coordinates a Kähler potential. And then, but the Kähler potentials have the property that no matter which one you choose, you always get the same Kähler metric. So the terms that show up in the fully expanded Lagrangian are always the same, even though you might allow a Kähler multiple. Now, G should be acting on everything, so G has to act on X, and the true physical theory is only going to involve G invariant things. So it'll be X mod G in some appropriate sense. But it turns out that when you have this kind of formalism with the X mod G, there are terms in the equation of motion which tell you that you have to take the solution of what are called the D terms in the equation of motion. I don't have time to explain that today. Modulo G. And this process of taking a complex manifold with a group action and producing some other manifold, which often gets denoted that way, is the so-called symplectic reduction process.
Oh, I was expecting you want to say this is gauging.
No, I'm not gauging something. I'm formulating a theory which naturally has gauge fields and scalar fields, but I'm now going to allow the scalar fields to take values in some target, and the gauge fields really are in some bundle over that target space. And then I have a global action of the group on X, and I end up with a symplectic reduction. So the symplectic form is essentially this scalar form that we've discussed, which acts on there, and you get some lower dimensional effective target space for your manifold. So this construction here is called, so without thinking about the group action, it's a sigma model, and then when you look at it with a gauge field, it's a so-called gauged sigma model. You could do it in N equal 1 as well, and then you have a super potential as well, so that you would have a super potential term in a gauged sigma model in general. It's almost 5 o'clock. I will ask for questions. Stop here.
I thought the abstract was assigned for the Witten, but it's never shown up.
Well, this is the Lagrangian for Seidrig-Witten theory.
The one there.
Yeah, if I do, you know, SU2 with a certain number of flavors, then I'm in Seidrig-Witten theory. And tau shows up in Seidrig-Witten theory in interesting ways. It's true, I put that in the abstract, but it didn't get there.
Okay. Yep.
What kind of quotient are you taking? Is that like a GIT one?
Well, I mean, literally, I should expect to take a quotient. This is something called symplectic reduction, which is equivalent to a GIT quotient, but is formulated slightly differently. It's formulated using a symplectic form on X, and you this D-term equation is something called the moment map for the group action with respect to the symplectic form. You have to set that equal to zero and take the zeros of the moment map. Moment map often has a constant by which it can be shifted, so there can be more than one quotient, but you have to take zeros of the moment map, modulo the group action, and that's the space. So there's a theorem of Kempf and Ness, which shows that symplectic reductions are equivalent to GIT reductions under appropriate circumstances.
But then I still will go back to Seidrig-Witten. So I thought this is a SU2 theory, right? The one you wrote.
Well, right now I didn't say what group, but yes, it could be SU2.
But I thought you need something to do to Seidrig-Witten, which is a U1 theory, I think.
Okay, so it starts out life as SU2, and then it dynamically in the infrared is broken to a U1 theory.
So there's a difficult step of doing the flow this to infrared.
That's correct. That's right. So, in fact, what you get depends on values of this parameter tau, the complexified coupling. And if tau is, okay, if G is small, and you go to the infrared, then you end up getting the traditional story of SU2 gauge theory, which if you, for example, do the so-called topological twist, you end up with Donaldson theory as a result. But if you take strong coupling and realize that there is this interesting physics in as you go to the infrared, then you get an effective gauge theory of U1 in the infrared, and you have this monopole expansion, which is what led to the all the exciting topology. So I could try to give a lecture next quarter sometime, but you're not around much next quarter.
Probably not.
Yeah.
But just while we're
there. Well, some Friday when you're here, you let me know, and I'll try to
Yeah, that's really what I want to hear, because I know Yeah, I know this is the ultraviolet Donaldson theory. You're supposed to flow to the infrared of sample Witten.
Well, so actually, both in the ultraviolet, what you have to do is tune the parameter tau. That's the key thing.
That's what I'm going to ask you.
Strong coupling and weak coupling of the gauge theory, and then you flow to the infrared.
That's what I want to ask. The thing is, eventually you flow into infrared, you still have a bunch of tau, which I think there's some variety. Each tau have a different theory, or they are the same?
No, tau's a parameter for the, in the well, depends on how much matter you add to this. So the original Zeibrick-Witten was no matter. Very hard to say that without it turning into a joke. it had no matter. You can put in a little bit of matter, and then you get other theories which do slightly different things. But yeah, tau is essentially a parameter in the low energy theory. All right.
How about take down the offer? Well, here I'm going to email you.
Yeah.
This is great. This is much more compact than what I remember.
Yeah. Well, that's partly because a lot of the indices are suppressed, right?
Still.